Hello and welcome to the Gambling Files podcast. I'm one of your hosts, John Bruford. I'm joined by your other host, Fintan Costello. Fintan Costello, welcome.
Hello.
How's it going?
Good, good. Sun's out.
Guns out.
Was it skies out? Sun's out, guns out. Skies out, tides out. Yeah, shorts, flip-flops. I'm in my natural kind of state of undress. I love it.
Interesting you say that about the rhyming slogans, because whenever I hear anybody, you know, shout anything in the street, like, hey, Ted, how are you? I am calls out, balls out.
Don't do that, John. Don't do that.
Well, there are certain terms I'm banned from.
There's that restraining order for that, so behave.
Yeah, but you know, I've grown up a lot, Fintan. So
I know.
This is the 99th episode of the Gambling Files podcast.
99 episodes. Jesus Christ, you'd think we'd learn how to do it by now, wouldn't you?
Seriously. I mean, I've been listening to some podcasts recently. I have.
Have you?
I have.
Okay. I have. Good. Good for you.
Because I found a couple of really quite, well, one not so niche, one really very niche. As you know, I never listened to a podcast, and then I was like podcasting for a couple of years, and then I finally listened to a podcast.
Yep.
And that was the John Hughes podcast by Hadley Freeman, which was excellent, but it was way too short. And then I went into the, you know, I dived down the rabbit hole of podcasting, and I've been looking for some really new shit, and it's not there. So I'm toying with doing it myself. I probably
won't. Because you don't have enough on your plate. Okay. Yeah,
exactly.
All that free time you got.
Exactly. Cause you know, sleeping is overrated, as anybody will tell you. But now I found a Josie and the Pussycats podcast. Called Josie and the Podcats.
Fair enough.
And it's really good.
Good.
It is. It's two Australian folks doing it. It's mostly the female presenter, and she's a writer. I think she's a novelist and stuff. And she's just like a huge fan of Josie and the Pussycats, the movie. But she goes right back to the origins of the comics. She speaks to the founder of the comics, the family daughter.
I love that.
Yeah, they go right into it.
That's great.
And they look at the context of the evolution of the comics, how Archie broke the comics code, how they had, I think it was the early 60s, you know, they had a band with two white members and a black member, which, you know, didn't happen kind of thing. And it's really, really interesting. It's really interesting the way he did it. There's a whole bonus episode about the fashions of Josie and the Pussycats.
Nice.
But it's good. And I'm really enjoying it. And it's making me think there's some potential here for all that free time I've got.
What would you do?
Now, there's niche and there's hyper niche.
That's where the money is.
Exactly. I'm just in it for the dollars.
If you look at the adult industry, it's the money's in the niche. Like, really obscure niche.
There is that. I'm going to have an OnlyFans. No. I've probably mentioned this before, but there's an actor, what they used to call a character actor. He was very active, late 70s and early, well, through the 80s. And he it's a guy called Brian James, Brian with an O. And he's just one of those people that's just completely forgotten, pretty much. With the exception of a couple of movies that were quite big. He was in The Fifth Element. He was in Blade Runner. But he was brilliant. I mean, there's only one thing I saw him do where I thought, dear God, why? And that was when he did the worst Cockney accent in the history of the world in Tango and Cash. But what I was thinking about was something, the name of it that I've got in my head, it's called Not Even a Footnote, The Brian James Story, to actually try and track down people that knew him, because he died quite young. He was only about 54 when he died. It was about 20 years ago. So people will still be alive.
Mm.
Whether I can find people that knew him and get some of his background and the context of when he was in some of these wonderful movies. But also just something about those forgotten people that are the texture in movies. You know, these sort of niche little actors who actually do an awful lot to create the fabric of a scene and the fabric of a movie. He's brilliant in Blade Runner. I think he's the first person you see in Blade Runner. He's the first replicant that's interviewed. So, I mean, he's only in it for a couple of minutes. But his scene sets the tone for the film and the context for the search and everything. And it's just like, I really fancy doing that.
Do it.
With all my free time. But speaking of free time.
Yeah.
One of my clients and friend of the podcast, Dr. Michael Auer, it was announced a couple of days ago, I think. Necton has been sold or acquired by, I guess on these things, it depends which side you talk to. It's merged with or been bought by. But they've been bought by OpenBet.
I hope they backed up the truck and just drowned him in cash. I am so happy for him. I'm hope it's like SecuraCore showed up, beep, 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 beep. It's reversing it into his fucking driveway and just dumping the bullion on his fucking driveway.
They're not daft. I'm sure they've had offers over the years. You know, they've changed the landscape of RG.
Oh, for sure. They've
not just in research, but in how they've approached it and how they've approached data analysis in using the AI.
But their install base, like, they've pretty much got a monopoly in Germany, and then they were rapidly expanding globally. Like, it was just, it was inevitable.
Yeah.
So I hope it was juicy. I hope it was big.
I don't know any details.
Well, it's OpenBet's private equity owned, so they don't have to announce it. But then so much of UK sports books run on OpenBet, and
it's a very canny acquisition by them.
Mm. Oh, it's super, like, one of the big guys was inevitably going to do it. For sure.
But if you're looking at a company, so you got like Andreas, Michael, Nige, the recently appointed sales and marketing director. I say recently appointed, I think he started in February, start of February, maybe late January. So you've essentially got three employees, as far as I'm aware. Plus, you know, they've probably got some remote ancillaries and software people, et cetera. You know, they've.
Mm.
But it's lean as can be. There's me doing a bit of steady freelance. But, yeah, if you come into this.
Your track record on this channel is pretty good. So you were doing PR stuff for Bonus Finder. Bonus Finder got bought. PR stuff for Necton. Necton got bought. So, you know, if there's anybody out there who's, like, you know, thinking about an exit, time to raise your profile and give John a shout. That's the, it's got a record.
Well, I was coming to the fact that I now do, in fact, have some free professional time. When I say free, I mean available rather than unpaid, just in case anybody from data team is listening.
Your pro bono days are behind you, are they?
Very much so. Very much so. You know, you're going to have to buy the model without the heated seats this year. So if anybody listening does need some of my very special kind of assistance, then please get in touch. I'm available, relatively cheap, and who knows, you might get sold. I mean, bought. That's more of a slave trading.
if you want to hear that
this SecuraCore van is reversing. Caution, bullion.
Caution, bullion is reversing. Heavy. Wide load, baby.
So, you know, if you want to hear that, then get in touch.
I'm delighted for him. That's great. Because they've been, it's that kind of classic thing, though. They've been doing this for a long time. You know, just the amount of research that they publish, amount of stuff that they've done. Like, this is an overnight success that took years. It's just a classic thing. I'm really, really happy for them. I love when people work hard and they get the success with it as well. It's really good news.
The growth in the last 3 years has been extraordinary. You know, globally in lotteries has been huge.
Mm.
But there was a point where GreenTube started using them, and suddenly everybody was like, oh, well, perhaps they're good then. Well, yeah. Duh.
Yeah. That's the thing. It's one of those things that it has a momentum behind it, that you kind of snowball. And then the way what I love about Dr. R, I should say, is that even though it's AI, like when you talk to him about it, he's like, well, look, it's just an equation. Let's not make it overcomplicated. So there's like a no bullshit behind it as well. Like there's a lot of people, like a lot of hand waving, oh, we're using AI. And at the end of the day, it's just maths. And the thing about systems like what they're doing is the more data you pump into it, the better it gets. And then, so the more clients they onboard, just the better the system gets. And then they're doing all the original research and everything. Like, I'm super happy. You just did it right. It was a great case. It's a great example of what to do. Do great work and it'll all take care of itself.
Shit, that's where I've been going wrong, isn't it?
Damn it.
So, I could mention our gracious corporate sponsors, or as I like to call them, the people that paid my rent this month. But I'm not going to, because
Why not, John?
Our guest on this 99th episode is, in fact, Paul Scalfa, who is a partner at Gaming Recruitment Solutions. That's grs-recruit.com.
For all your recruitment needs.
All of them.
And today we are talking about Las Vegas and the table games in Las Vegas. Odds are getting tighter, becoming more of a premium product. And there's a bit of a backlash. And we kind of talk through it all with Paul, and he kind of gives his view and experience. And because when he's not doing recruitment, he also does a lot of casino consultancy, and he's obviously got his history in land-based casinos. And he brings his expertise to bear and talks us through it. And I learned a lot, again, as I always do when Paul comes on.
It is worth emphasizing that Paul does have a lot of experience in land-based operations.
Huge amount.
Plus, it's something he's quite passionately interested in. He's one of those people, he seems to like knowing how shit works. I mean, when I first met Paul, and I know I have said this before, but was he the guy that opened the property? I can't remember. He was managing Asper's Newcastle, which, you know, I haven't been there for several years, but it was a cracking property. Really, really good. And much loved by Newcastle United footballers.
Ooh, and
I saw good old Nobby Solano in there several times.
What a name.
Well, would you rather be called Nobby or his actual name, which was Nolberto?
I think I'd take Nolberto, to be honest with you.
Yeah, but there is a storied history of the name Nobby for footballers.
What was his surname?
Solano.
Nobby Solano sounds like a porn star name.
Or an ice cream brand. Like... Dick-shaped ice cream.
With nuts in it.
Yeah. The nuts are at the bottom. There's an idea. If anybody's listening from an ice cream company, dick-shaped ice cream, nuts at the bottom. But anyway, I digress. Paul Scalfa, grs-recruit.com. Gaming Recruitment Solutions. Take it away. We're joined by today's guest in, I don't know whether it's our first or second episode this week. I can't actually remember. I think this is probably our first episode this week. Fintan and I are joined by corporate overlord Paul Sculfer of Gaming Recruitment Solutions. That's grs-recruit.com. Paul Sculfer, welcome.
Thanks. Hello, guys. How are we doing?
All good, mate.
Fucking good. Shit.
No. Weather not cheering you up?
Well, I can see it. I'm not in it, though.
Stuck here talking to me. Tough life.
Sucks to be me, I tell you. But apart from that, yeah, everything's brilliant, I suppose. You know? You shouldn't have asked.
No, I guess not.
Clearly, we regret it.
There's a thing in this area where, you know, when people greet each other in the street, even strangers or nodding acquaintances, mm-hmm. you say, all right. Now, a lot of people that move to the area think they're actually being asked if they're all right.
Oh.
And it takes them a little while to adjust to the fact that nobody actually cares.
Yeah. The correct procedure is a half smile and a very short nod, a big nod, and people start thinking that's an invitation to talk, and that's really not acceptable. Mm. Just one of those. That'll do it.
Went through a period of doing, you know, cheeky dances and finger guns at people, and then, you know, one day I'm in Los Angeles, and it had a completely different connotation. I learned that one the hard way.
Yeah, I wouldn't do finger guns.
I was walking down the street in Alabama, and the next thing you know, it's amazing. Cultural differences. Yeah.
Yeah, indeed.
So, Paul, we've been talking about this, doing this episode for a little while because, not because of your recruitment brilliance, grs-recruit.com. Oh, actually, have you placed anybody recently that you feel the need to, you know, brag about?
Well, yes. I mean, it's an ongoing process. Super Christine, based out in Malta, is doing a great job for us. She's focusing on the online world, and she's made a couple of placements last week, which is one smallish one, one biggish one, which is great. We're still, I'm just trying to think in terms of what's the latest one that I can talk about. We placed the outgoing general manager of Aspers in Stratford, who started work with her new job yesterday. That was a big result for us because, I mean, she's lovely. She's one of the nicest people you could ever imagine.
Fantastically
good at her job.
I think I've met her.
Yeah, Geordie woman.
Name's just completely gone out of my head.
Beatrice. So she started with her new employer yesterday, and she's going to do great. It was just time for a change for her. She'd been a good long while where she was and decided to do something new and kind of asked us to give her a hand, and we made some introductions. And she's a good example of the best kind of placements because you know she's going to do great. She's been brilliant wherever she's worked. And she, you know, I'd be astounded if in a year's time she hasn't made herself kind of indispensable. So, there's constant stuff. We're doing a mixture of management and staff at the moment. We started out only aiming to do management, but we're doing staff for a casino in Morocco and the new Melco site in Cyprus, and they're going well. But, you know, it's kind of we're in the dozens of people we're trying to place at staff level. It's hard because, you know, for Cyprus we had 3,400 applications for a very limited number of jobs, and most of them are no good for one reason or another. But we're making progress. I think I can't remember exactly how many we've placed. They're about to open, so no doubt there'll be another surge just after they open, which it always happens. You open a new site, a bunch of people get disillusioned straight away or don't like their boss or whatever. So it'll be a long-term job, that one, I think. Keeps us busy anyway.
And a casino in Morocco? Isn't Morocco a Muslim country?
I believe so. There are a few of them. The one we're dealing with is a kind of, isolated is the wrong word, but a almost an integrated resort, not kind of Vegas scale, but you know, everything you want or everything you, well, two ways of looking at it. Either everything you want is on the resort or you don't want to leave it anyway. You know, it's a luxury 5-star affair with walls around it for a reason.
Fintan, I think similar with a lot of North African countries, the majority of the population is Muslim, but there's a strong European stroke Christian influence. So, I mean, if you look at Egypt historically, it's between 70-30 and 80-20 Christian to Muslim.
It's probably not as strict. Like, obviously, it's like any religion, there's degrees of adherence, I suppose, is the word, right? So you could be like, I'm technically born Catholic, but who cares, right? That kind of thing would be there.
But I think these places also, they do a lot of trade from, obviously from tourists, but Morocco in particular, also Montenegro, which actually Will from Fitzdares was talking about when he was talking sports betting. The Montenegrin casinos do similar. They do very good rebate deals and affiliate deals even for offline casinos. So, you know, if you send 50 decent punters to Montenegro and they do a ton of money, then as the agent, you'll get a payback or you get a payoff. And likewise, if you're a big player, you'll get bigger rebates there than anywhere else. So there's that's part of the equation as well.
But why is that? Is that like what makes? Is that just how they do business in Montenegro, or there's something there where this is important, or geography wise, or what's going on there?
Part of it, I guess, and I don't know for sure, but it'll be the tax rate. There'll be for every pound that you win, somebody goes in tax, and if the tax is low, then there's a bit more firepower to attract people with. And I guess it'll just be historically the way it's grown up. I know Morocco is reasonably well known for it, for offline casinos, and I keep hearing about Montenegro. Occasionally you'll see an offline casino running a competition for a trip to Montenegro, and there's a reason for that, is that, you know, whatever it costs to send them out there, they'll get that paid back by the operator out there, because, you know, it's same with cruise lines. Cruise lines do a lot of that. Many's the offline casino where they'll have a big do and you'll get a cruise voucher, because the casino operator knows that, you know, these people are going to spend their holiday money somewhere that isn't in their casino. Why not get them to spend it somewhere where they get 15% back? It's a sneaky trick, but the customer doesn't care. From their point of view, it's a free cruise.
Wow, that's super interesting.
It's the same affiliate business you're in, just looks a bit different.
It sounds way smarter.
It really isn't. I can tell you that. There's people who make a living off of this just because they've got a big black book full of decent punters. And if you know what you're doing, you can make a good living out of it if you've got connections at both ends, punters and operators.
Mm. All right, well, we'll talk after this.
Damn it. But what we were talking about was... a lot of people were remarking fairly recently on the old business social media about the tightening odds on tables, specifically in Vegas. And it is quite a big shift. It's not quite as big a shift as, you know, adding that number to the national lottery in the UK. That was scandalous. Absolutely scandalous. And not explain to the punters at all that it's just completely demolished the odds of winning. But, you know, it's more appealing because now you get more rollovers. Yes, because nobody can win the jackpot.
Yeah.
But people spend more on the rollovers. Yes, and they still have the diminishing chances. But anyway, I digress slightly. But it was looking at the table games in Vegas, and people were saying, it was blackjack, wasn't it? Was it changed to 6 to 5 or something?
Yeah, so if you're playing on a $10 table, historically, and in most of the UK, you hit a blackjack, you'll win $15. The latest trend is to make that so you actually win $12 instead of $15. It doesn't sound like much because you don't feel like you get that many blackjacks, but it pretty much quadruples the edge from, if you're a decent player, from around about 0.5% to around about 2%, depending on the other rules. So, I mean, it's obviously that makes a massive, massive difference to how profitable the games are. All other things being equal, it will quadruple the expected win per dollar staked. there's a bunch of different things. I mean, Vegas is the kind of shop window where it's quite obvious as trends change. You know, there are subtle things. I mean, these things are happening everywhere because everywhere needs to make more money and gaming staff are getting more and more expensive. So it's tougher and tougher to offer playing positions. I saw the first 6 to 5 blackjack I've ever seen in the UK 2 weeks ago. I'd never seen it before. We were in the Empire in Leicester Square and they had 6 to 5 there, which on the face of it shouldn't really surprise me. It's the right spot for it. It's a relatively... here today, gone tomorrow, customer base. Well, it's a bit of a blend, I think, of locals and tourists. So at the bottom value table, you've just got to make more money, or their perception is they've got to make more money. I think Vegas, it's been going on for a long time gradually, but it started to really become more obvious as 6-5 blackjack has overtaken 3-2. You know, 00 has been standard there. You see 000 now and again, or it was now and again. Now, the cheapest table is regularly 000, and a lot of other things. The RTP on slots has been screwed down a little bit. It feels like, you know, they ground it down a bit coming out of COVID. It's never been pushed back up again. But I think the amount of outrage over it is ill-judged. Well, the first thing to say is Vegas is making more and more money. It's record year on year months every month. Mm. So something's going right. I think the criticism of it is because if you push it too far, then people stop playing. Well, it's been going on for a decade, and it hasn't been pushed too far yet because people are still playing. So fundamentally, that will happen. I wrote an article about it 7 years ago in 2016 saying, surely they've gone too far this time. This was about general costs in Vegas as well as the gaming and, you know, the kind of minibar fees and they've got variable pricing or surge pricing in the shops now in most of the casinos. If you want beers, they're more expensive on a Friday night than a Tuesday night. And I thought then, you sound like I'm joking, but I'm not.
I love it. Well,
I thought they'd started to go too far then, but it's gone way further and there's no signs of it causing any damage. It's just that kind of elasticity of demand. You can push people way further than we all as industry kind of veterans thought they'll put up with it. They want to play.
Which makes, like, if you look at the, like, we've talked about this a lot with Jennifer Gaynor as well, when she comes on to talk about Vegas. And when you look at the Vegas model, you know, like just looking at the sports teams. So UFC, hockey, American football, baseball is coming. Potentially a basketball team you could imagine in the future. You know, there's sort of just as a sporting destination, plus all the shows, all this kind of stuff. So that, does the recreational punter actually care? You know, you've booked the weekend, you're flying in, you've got the babysitter at home, you've got a pocket full of cash and you're here to spend it. So I know I can see where you're coming from that perspective. It's not really it's a mass market entertainment product.
Yeah.
And they're not, like, if they've come all the way to Vegas, they're not that price sensitive.
Yeah, I think that's it. I mean, you've, from the gambling point of view, you've got to think, what are you actually selling people? I think most people are realistic enough to know you're not selling them the chance of a big win, or All right, there's a possibility that you can have a big one, but that's not really what people are playing for. What you're selling them is time spent gambling and enjoying it. And if that time gets more expensive, then there's it's basic economics about that elasticity of demand. If it gets a bit more expensive, they're still going to play. And from an executive's point of view, it's probably, you're really thinking about, and it sounds terrible in a service-led environment, you're thinking about processing people. They've got X amount of money they're prepared to spend on gambling. You want to get it off them really as quickly and as efficiently as possible, which sounds really cynical, but that is exactly what's happening, whether you put a service spin on it or not. And, you know, Vegas is right at one end of the spectrum of stickiness of customers. You know, they're going to come in for, you know, typically, if they're US citizens, 3 or 4 days, a couple of times a year. So, you know, if they have a experience that's a bit more expensive than they wanted, maybe it doesn't matter as much as if you're a high street casino in the UK, where it's the same people you see all the time. But I think what the central lessons are the same either way, at both ends of the spectrum. You can push customers around more than you think. Part of it is everybody is really critical of this, or it seems everyone is critical of it, who's got a lot of time in the industry. And I've had some lively debates on LinkedIn recently, the last few days, about this. We've all spent a whole career trying always to give customers good news, always never say no if you can avoid it, always give them what they want. But the fact is, with gambler, with table gaming in particular, and to an extent slot gaming in the UK, because you're so restricted to how many you can have, you've got to start dictating to them what the price point is. You know, first time I really thought about this was 11 years ago. We opened the casino in Blackpool and started off with 20 slots, the maximum you're allowed. And we started off with the minimum play was 5p a line or 5p a spin. We thought, you know, it's a new casino. We need to introduced people to the games. And, you know, about 3 months later, I was there when the manager, who's a top guy called Richard, was having a conversation with one of the customers after they put it up to 50p minimum per spin. And she sort of said to him, well, I can't afford to play here. And he sort of looked back at her and said, yeah, you're right. The thinking being, she can't afford to play, but if someone stood behind her, he can at 50p. So yeah. You know, you can't keep everybody happy. And the idea that you could is not realistic. So, you know, it's a maths-based, it's an algorithm-based question. There is room for gut feel in terms of how you run these things, but you don't know. I wouldn't say you don't know. You've pushed it too far until you find out the hard way. But by eye, Vegas pushed it too far 10 years ago, and they're still pushing. They're still taking it further, and they're still making more money. There'll probably be more unhappy customers who can't afford to play. And you go on the strip on a Friday night in any of the upscale casinos, it's maybe $25 blackjack. Probably 50. I'm not playing $50 blackjack, but that doesn't matter because there are people who will.
Well, I can play that thanks to your sponsorship of this podcast.
Not for very long. I mean, in terms of being able to play, not for the sponsorship link.
That's very fair. But we've constantly heard over the years from suppliers, slot companies, etc., that, you know, oh, the players, they really love our mathematics. And I've always had in the back of my head, I don't think they're that aware of your mathematics. They're aware of how many times the machine's hitting, but that's not an awareness of the actual mathematics, right?
I think
in many, many, many cases, I think it's probably different on table games. There's probably much greater awareness on table games because there is a smaller set of outcomes and a narrower kind of play experience than on a slot where you've got bonus games and blah and blah and somebody coming and bringing you a drink, etc. Never happens at the tables. But shit, where was I going with this? Can either of you remember where I was going with this?
Start with game math.
Game math.
Player awareness.
Yeah, no. So I was having a conversation with a chap. He was at one of the casinos in Birmingham, in the UK. And we were chatting on the phone one day, and he says, "Yeah, you're not going to believe the conversation I just had with my customers." I said, "Try me." He said, "They've just been asking me," and I'm sorry, any listeners, if I'm repeating myself, but I do love this story. "They've just been insisting that we get a 00 roulette." They think that the 00 roulette is looser and more advantageous to the customer, and that we're giving them a shitty deal by just having the single zero roulette. One of them has even asked me for a 000 roulette.
Nice.
And Why stop there? These are people that play blackjack, that play roulette. This is his roulette customers in a very decent casino, and they don't get that little basic thing about their house. Yeah. And it blew my mind. And it blew his, because he said, I explained it to them. I explained why the single zero is the best wheel for them as a player. But they weren't having it. They thought I was having one over on them. And I'm like, fuck.
Wow. The lack of sophistication. And what really scares me is the lack of sophistication amongst casino management sometimes. You know, there's plenty of guys out there way sharper than me. But from a customer point of view, there are elements in which it makes sense. I mean, when Caesars introduced 00s in the UK, they had a little marketing campaign basically saying, we're adding a zero, but you'll be able to play at a lower minimum. And the theory is, you know, in the UK, people tend to play roulette very differently from the way they play it in Vegas. In Vegas, it tends to be they'll play 10 chips and pick their favorite numbers. In the UK, people like to play 100 chips and put little stacks on everything, and it makes the game just a different style. So what Caesars would do, would there be, the first time I remember seeing it was in the Golden Nugget, wherever, where they put all the other tables up to £2 a chip, then brought in 00 at £1 or maybe even 50p to say, Minimum is cheaper, play as many chips as you want. It's obviously a crap deal, but if you like playing big stacks of chips, then it kind of makes sense. If you're not playing forever, the doubling, more or less doubling of the edge doesn't kill you. And I'm just, you know, again, on blackjack, I'll play 6 to 5 blackjack. I'm not going to play for very long. If I can play at a lower minimum, so it just feels like I can you know, the house edge affects you, obviously, the more or the longer that you play. I get bored after half an hour, so I'd rather play at a minimum that I can afford, knowing that it's worse for me in the long run. Yeah, you're better off playing £25 a hand on 6 to 5 blackjack than you are playing £10 a hand on 3 to 2. Let me get that straight. Try again. You're better off playing £25 a hand on 3 to 2 blackjack than you are playing £10 on 6 to 5 in terms of expected loss. But I'll probably still play the £10 because I don't want the volatility of playing at £25. You know, you can do £500 in an hour. I don't want to do that. Going back to the lack of sophistication, I mean, I've dealt with casino managers, shift managers over the years, not so much these days, who had no idea what house edge meant. You know, you talk to them about, well, how's the guy playing on blackjack? What kind of edge is he playing to? Where, you know, perfect strategy would be 0.5%. You know, Friday night idiot who will take cards no matter what, up at 5 or 6%. They didn't know what I was talking about. It is scary.
But that's bonkers when you think what we are in an industry which is all about data. And the sophistication in gathering that data across the gaming floor, completely across the gaming floor, from everything to the player taking their money out, where they spend it, what needs emptying, or, you know, RFID chips, or it's the amount of data on the movement of currency in the casino, on player behavior. We've got all this analysis on all of that stuff. We should be the most scientific industry on the planet outside of science, and yet we're not.
It reminds me a bit of London cab drivers in an age of Uber. I mean, you're right, there are other reasons why you might want to get a black cab, but apparently there are still something like 1,000 people doing the knowledge every year, which is 3 to 5 years of driving up every street in London. And you sort of want to say to them, what you're learning has almost no value. Almost none in a world of sat nav, and sat navs are only going to get better. It's the same thing, I think. When, you know, don't get me wrong, there being a pit boss, as in generally the guy in the UK certainly who determines which tables open at what minimum with which dealer. You know, there it is an art. The experience does count. It does help, but the table optimization systems they have now. I mean, the kind of, I would say the brand leader is a company called Tangum, who, you know, you feed in 6 months of data, what tables you've opened, at what minimum, and what level of play you've got out of it. And this, the theory behind it, it works, the bigger the casino, the better it works, or the you know, because you've got more flexibility. But in theory, you know, you feed in all the data, and it will say, right, on a Monday night, you should open 2 more blackjacks at $25 because you're not optimizing your revenue otherwise. It's way more complex than that. But the theory behind it is dead simple. You know, if you give me 6 months data for a casino, and by eye, you'll see some things that just don't make any sense. It feels right when you're there looking at it shift by shift as a pit boss, but you step back a bit and then, you know, reallocating resources just to make things more efficient. And every casino's got a limiting factor. In the UK at the moment, generally, in most sites, it's availability of staff. You know, you can't get as many gaming staff as you want. Now, we have almost given up. Well, with one exception, we've given up trying to recruit gaming staff in the UK because there just aren't enough out there and they're not moving. So most UK casinos, your limiting factor is how many staff hours you can actually put on the floor. So you want to maximise every staff hour that you've got. And if that means that Saturday nights are really, really busy, but with people who don't want to spend money, or more importantly, don't want to spend money quickly, then you're better off having some dissatisfied customers on a Saturday so that you can take care of the faster spending customers on a Sunday, for example. You know, not every casino is the same. I was talking to the guys who run one of the independent casinos in London, and their limiting factor is more square footage. They've only got a certain amount of space, so you're balancing off F&B versus slots versus electronic gaming versus tables. Their starting situation is a bit different. They could get more staff, but they haven't got space to open tables to deploy them. Anyway, it's going back to the pit bosses and the optimization systems. Oh. You know, these things do operate live as well. They say, you know, right now you make more money if you do this or did that. It gets quite complicated, and I think there, you know, these people I've been debating with, if that's the right word, on LinkedIn, I'm not sure that they really get what's possible. You know, you can, you know, the debate I had early on, which is bordering on laughable, was some guy said that you make more money out of out of seven players playing blackjack at $5 than you do out of two players playing blackjack at $25. Well, firstly, that's absolute bollocks. The fact is a blackjack table runs twice as fast with two players, so you end up making about three times as much money from two at 25 than you do seven at five. And then our counter argument to that was, yeah, but full tables look better. And this is not data driven analysis. This is
but even the basic maths of, if it's, what was it, seven players at $5 a hand,
yeah,
is $35 versus, yeah, two players at $25 is $50. Now, I'm definitely not a casino expert, but like, even just straight up maths just seems like, well, actually, it's better.
I mean, absolutely, but there are more levels to it. You know, I was trying to make the point that it's blatantly obvious. But even if it was seven players at $10, that's $70 stake to hand versus two at 25 is 50. But the two hand table literally goes twice
the
as
volume.
Far.
Yeah.
So, and then you get into, not if you're limited by staff, you're not just looking at those kind of number algorithms, if that's the right word. You need to look at the pit as a whole to figure out, well, maybe neither of those tables should be open, because you should have a three card poker table open, because mostly on a Tuesday night at this time you get some £100 players in. Then you go a step beyond that, and this is where it starts to get beyond my level of experience. The dwell time at a blackjack table, for example, tends to change depending on how many players there are. The more players there are, the shorter period people will play for, because it's frustrating, it's slow, you're a bit crowded elbow to elbow. You need to figure that kind of thing as well. If you want to be, you know, that's when it gets really diminishing marginal returns. But it, the whole point of it for me is it has to be data driven, and saying things like you prefer to have seven players at five because a full table makes the place look busier. It's just bollocks, isn't it? I mean, it's not, yeah, it has no standing. And, you know, add into the fact that every major casino in the world uses some form of this optimization software, because the amount of data is too much for a pit boss to figure out, not just there and then, but, you know, amalgamating across 6 months of warehouse data. And it's just, it's, you know, it's not an argument I'm having in the sense of trying to win the discussion. The discussion was won 10 years ago. It's just a question of trying to get people to see where we're at now. And yeah, it's very frustrating.
It feels like a very, like, you know, if you get what you incentivize, right, is the saying. And like, if you think of, like, okay, somebody you're having who has this opinion, like, maybe when they came up through, everything was done on eyeball, the owner walks through, sees the full tables, things are clearly going well, they get a pat on the back for that, you're doing a good job.
Yeah.
And it's that kind of more just eyeballing stuff rather than, and I think, you know, my guess would be, working in a casino, there's obviously a mix of skills, right? So you need really, really good interpersonal skills.
Yeah.
And really good analytical skills. And people who can do both are probably pretty rare. You probably got, like, people who are great interpersonal stuff and people who love a spreadsheet, but they're not necessarily the same person.
Yeah.
I suppose that must be something that's even more important in these days, because it's obviously, it's such a big business. It has to be data-led, rephrase question. You were talking about, like, the pit boss is in charge of making a lot of these decisions.
Yeah.
How much of that will start to get, or gets taken away from the pit boss, where they get given the sheet of, please implement this plan?
Yeah.
The computer says X.
Yeah, but there's been plenty of friction as that process has happened. I mean, there's always room for a skilled pit boss for things that really can't be modeled properly. You know, this bit, when you're at a decent level of gaming, this punter prefers that dealer because he gets on better with them. This particular player will only play for a certain amount of time because we know he always leaves at 11. So let's make sure we get him isolated so he gets the best experience. And also the kind of the service element, the underlying truth of all of this is that you can push customers around more than you think. But that only stands up if everything else is right. So, you know, the service standards have got to be up to a baseline. You know, I think where people find it most nervous to be optimizing everything and therefore definitely pissing a few people off, is the theory is if you're in a two casino town and you tell Fred, who does a grand a week slowly, that, well, he can't play here, he can't play on that table at that time at that minimum because it doesn't make sense to us, you'll never see him again and you lose that money. And I think that doesn't, it happens a lot less than people think, because, you know, you spend your whole career talking to customers, doing what they want, doing what they say, trying to make them happy. But the truth is, they're much less likely to walk than you think if everything else is right. If the, mm-hmm. you know, if the product, service, and environment is right, then you can squeeze them more than you think. And, you know, Vegas have been squeezing very hard for a very long time. And, you know, when strip casinos started to go to 6-5 blackjack, there was an uproar, an outrage. Well, no one's going to play there. They'll just go down the road. And then what happened was nobody went down the road, so everybody started going 6-5. There's way less negative reaction than people think. And it wouldn't be fair to say if it'll work in Vegas, it'll work anywhere, because they aren't the same kind of perishable customer base. But it still stands up everywhere. And any place we've worked where you make changes to minimums or RTPs that you're a bit nervous about. I mean, it's fair to say, it's no secret, Genting nationally jacked up their roulette minimums very, very sharply. Most of their sites went to £5 a chip, which was way scarier. You know, if I'd been in charge of Genting, there's no way I'd have done that from 50p or a pound in most places. Mm. Because they were short staff, it was driven by COVID when you only allowed 3 players per table and you had to kind of screen them off. And they found they were making a ton more money. And again, if you play in tables in the Hippodrome, more at the Hippodrome is more Vegas end in the sense that the customers come and go, but their minimums on tables are absolutely ferocious now. You know, you used to be able to play £10 blackjack on a Friday night, no chance now. I couldn't tell you, I would guess it'd be £15 at 6-5 or £25 minimum, just because, again, they've seen the light, really, and trying to offer everything everyone wants at the price point they want is just nowhere near efficient.
It makes perfect sense. And you would imagine, particularly in a Vegas, where obviously in the UK you've got the slot machine limit, number of slot machines limitation. Yeah. And somewhere like Vegas, you assume they just want everybody on the slot machines ultimately. So making the table games more expensive just feels like the natural progression of that.
Yeah, I mean, the UK equivalent, and really everywhere in the world, is pushing onto the slot machines is a dream. The next best thing, and almost as good as pushing them onto the electronic table games. You know, there's a huge uptick in the number of terminal games that you'll see, certainly in Vegas. I mean, the UK, it's a bit more challenging in the UK because we're not allowed to have RNG gaming, so everything has to be based on a physical ball or physical cards, which makes card games a bit impractical. But, you know, every UK operator wants as many of their roulette players to play on terminals as possible. And in most countries, the kind of amphitheater we talked about last time I was on, kind of amphitheater style gaming with 60 terminals clustered around a wheel and a table where someone's pulling cards. You know, they're not doing that just because it's a big showpiece. They're doing it because it's a hell of a lot cheaper to run. You can accommodate, you know, 60 players in comfort for 10% of what it costs to put them all on spread them across 10 tables. It's not. Again, there's still some kickback and resistance to it, and it's not proper gaming. But, you know, if I own a casino, I don't give a shit whether it's proper gaming. I give a shit whether I make money or not, and that's the business we're in, and that's what drives it all.
I would like to just take a moment to just apologize to listeners, because Fenton's been typing very loudly.
Everything was it?
During it was the conversation. Not. And I messaged him to say, could you calm that down a bit? He messaged me back. He said, fuck you. You're not the boss of me. Eat my bum hole.
Did he lost his mind as well?
Oh, mate. You would. Here's the WhatsApp conversation. You don't have to prove it, Fenton.
I mean, I think I do. All of our listeners will be, they'll know. They know. Yeah. They know that they understand the dynamic here. They dance lightly across the keyboard.
It's like you hate your keyboard. It's unbelievable.
So, in a totally unrelated question, what were you Googling, John?
I wasn't Googling anything. I was telling Fenton to eat my bumhole.
Probably finishing his newsletter.
Well,
no, yeah. I finished that before we started. I was a bit late with it today. I was late with it, so you know, I had to get that out there.
Let me just back to Paul for a sec. Where does it go? Sorry, John. Just doing a podcast here. If you don't mind.
Just knock me out when you're done.
So you've obviously there's always a, you know, like you started like elasticity of demand or elasticity of demand. There's always that kind of top of the curve where it stops, right?
Yeah.
What's the, like, how far do you feel? And obviously there's huge margin savers, like the automated machines or the amphitheater stuff, particularly when you've already said like staffing is a limiting factor for a lot of places. So it feels like there's still a lot of headroom left on margin to get there. But where do you feel like once we get to there, it's going to need another breakthrough or a change in technology or whatever?
Well, I think, and this is, I mean, I've been in the business for 30 odd years myself, so I can't help but have some old school tendencies. And I think I would be concerned if you try to operate something that you call a casino without tables. So I think fundamentally, if you take all the tables out, it becomes something else. So I think there's always going to be a place for tables. I mean, I've been involved with places that have four or five tables. We're working on one in Aberdeen at the moment that has effectively seven. If you take those out, it becomes a different animal. It doesn't mean to say it can't make money. I mean, arcades in the UK make an ungodly amount of money. And I mean, compared to, they make casinos look like just on a earnings per member staff basis, they're miles ahead. I've been working with a arcade operator recently, and the you wouldn't believe there are a lot of them 24 hours in the UK now as well, arcades. So you're talking about say 30 to 50 slots in a reasonably nice environment, no booze but tea and coffee on hand at all times. The machines aren't particularly expensive to rent. You're in secondary locations, you're kind of in high streets, but you're not generally next to Marks and Spencer's, you're a bit off the prime spot, so rents aren't crazy. And to run all of that, you know, if it's a casino with six tables, reception, cash desk, and food and beverage staff, realistically you can't do that with less than about 40 staff. You can have an arcade that has a top line that's only a little bit off a small casino, and you run it on six staff. You know, 35, lots of 20 grand, 25 grand average, yeah, you've saved nearly £1 million in employment costs, and the top lines aren't wildly out of kilter. That's what drives me thinking that it's not me thinking. Clearly, the future is pushing as many people as possible towards electronics. But you look at the arcade business and realize they have got to the end point without tables, and it works.
So, if particularly when we look at the UK, where the betting shops, obviously there was the whole FOBTY, which are the fixed odds betting terminals and the roulette machines and all of this kind of thing. And there was a huge, you know, they were opening betting shops to stick FOBTY. Basically, it was just an excuse for FOBTYs. Why didn't they just start opening arcades?
They are doing. There's been a bit of an explosion. I mean, in some cases, they've literally taken over betting shop premises. They're a bit too small for an arcade generally, but one of the major operators has been opening a couple of arcades a month for two or three years now, to the extent where it's, you know, some towns are pretty much saturated. You've got a lot more capacity in an arcade. You know, you're talking 40 or 50 slots, whereas, as you say, bookies had the betting counter, which was almost irrelevant by then, plus four FOBTs. You don't need as many arcades, so they've got the same kind of demand. And of course, you can't, the stakes and prizes on offer in arcades aren't as, you can't spend money as quickly in an arcade as you could do in a betting shop, from an FOBT point of view. But yeah, it is growing enormously. There have been a couple of new entrants into the market with varying degrees of success, because they're a different animal. You need to know what you're doing. I've run a couple of arcades years ago, and all I learned was that I didn't really know what I was doing. They were attached to bingo clubs when I used to work in bingo. But it is a slightly different world. And I've been saying for years now in the UK, specifically in the UK, that small casinos are the future. And when I say small, I don't mean small as defined by the law, because that is a category under the 05 Act. I'm talking about half a dozen tables, 20 slots, which might be 40 when the law changes, 40 electronic roulettes, and just catering to people who go to play, you know, and or want to have a drink and watch other people play. And it does still feel to me like that's the way forward. And to your point about where's it going to end, it is going to end that tables will be a rich person's game only. You know, it'll get to the stage where unless you're in a world of being happy to have expected loss of £100 an hour, you won't be able to play on a table because there can be loss leaders to a certain extent to make the place look and feel like a casino, which is a bit edgy and a bit dangerous kind of thing and a bit exciting. But staff are getting more and more expensive and harder to find. I don't see that changing anytime soon. So it will get to the stage where if you're in a casino, if you're rich, you can play the tables. If you're not rich, you can watch people play the tables, which is the next best thing for some people. And then you can play on the terminals for, you know, an expected loss of £10 an hour because that's all you're worth. You're not worth dedicating a human being to taking care of you. Every other walker, you know, it, cliche, but the automatic tills at Tesco's, you know, the no-till Amazon stores, everything's going towards fewer and fewer people because people are expensive and they go off sick.
I was thinking while you were talking about what people do.
I know. I thought Paul was off stick yesterday. I thought Paul was making a dig. I thought John had been complaining.
No, I was saving that.
Pretty sure you're expensive too, Vincent.
Oh, I am.
Thinking about arcades being off the main street and all that, but then I was remembering. There was one, and I don't know if it's still there, but if you were at Leicester Square recently, there was one next to the Hippodrome, which the Hippodrome bought.
Yeah, Crystal Rooms, yeah.
Yeah. Did they keep that as an arcade, or have they incorporated it into the building?
They've incorporated it. I think I'm right in saying I don't head down that way much. I think it's more so like a Punta Banco area, aimed at more at the Chinese market, I believe. That square footage in that part of the world is about as expensive as you'll find anywhere, I guess. So they figured that a ground floor table gaming operation would be more advantageous to them. But I mean, around Leicester Square, there are a number of arcades. I forget, I was shown into one the other day because they've got a full-scale electronic roulette rig in it. It's just the back of, I think, Chinatown. We're still on, I guess it'll be, I forget what the category C, but I think it's category C. So the maximum stake is £1. So we've got an electronic roulette with six terminals where all you can stake is £1. The speed of play is reduced as well. So it cannot make, physically, you cannot make more than about 50 quid an hour or something across six terminals, but they put it in there as a big showpiece. But some of the arcades, including that one, they're just fantastic inside. I mean, you're talking about, it looks and feels, other than the fact there's no tables, like a casino. And what people are doing with arcades now is extraordinary. It's not even a poor man's casino. It's just a casino without tables. It is a different world. Mm. But again, critically, you don't have to pay a ton of staff because you don't need a reception in the same way. You're not even thinking about offering a restaurant-type food offer. You're not allowed to offer booze. So, you know, three-quarters of the staff you need in a normal casino, bingo, or other leisure environment, you don't need to offer. And you're still a cash business where people come in with cash, leave without any cash, and have still had a good time. So, you know, to a certain extent, if you know what you're doing, you're printing money.
That's super interesting.
Well, I'm in the wrong business, really. I should be in arcades. But having worked with the guys who operate arcades, you realize how much you don't know. They're proper professionals as well.
I'd never fit in then.
Is it because, you know, I suppose the stereotype of arcades is it's a little bit, you know, it's a little bit grittier.
Yeah.
Like the business behind it is kind of, it's a bit grittier. It's a bit more
grubby.
There's a baseball bat behind the counter kind of situation. That's kind of what it feels like. Is that just me being?
I think some are, some aren't. You're still going to have the odd machine get smashed up with a chair. I mean, that happens in casinos. Certainly happens in betting shops more than the press would have you believe, or more even than the press would have you believe. You read the reports of someone's thrown a stool through a window. First, you ask, "What kind of stool?" "Oh, right, a stool that you sit on." that happens too, believe me. But I think they're a bit more low rent from what I've seen. They generally the
so,
the spend per head, I don't suppose, would be wildly different. I mean, no one ever believes you when you tell people in casinos in the UK the average spend per visit outside of London is about £27. Arcades, they don't track people in and out in the same way, so they don't necessarily know precisely. But it's a bit further down the scale. There's a wider spread. You get some really shitty arcades where, you know, you wouldn't want to go in a suit because people would want to know what's going on. But I think, generally speaking, the two big brands in the UK, they're relatively upscale. They're aware of issues around loan working at night, same as betting shops were. So I think there's a bit of that, but they're not, the CCTV's not as overt. So if there's going to be some bad behaviour, then there will be, but it's not, you know, it's not as bad as it. It's not lock, stock, and two smoking barrels, baseball bat, and kind of widespread organised crime. There are two operators who, I think they have around about 200 arcades each, and they're pretty much corporations. You know, they're serious players, and everything's above board. But it doesn't mean to say there isn't some unpleasantness, but you still get that in casinos now and again. So
supermarkets and pharmacies.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. There was a famous video of someone outside the business centre of a lively debate, i.e. a slanging match, at a bar, and then you see the guy shouting, then you see some guy shouting back, then you see a pint being thrown, then you see a chair being thrown. It was a proper escalation situation. Then I found out afterwards, when I looked at the background, it was a casino I'd helped open in Leeds, and you're looking at it thinking, I'm glad I don't work there anymore. But it's add alcohol to young people, and young boys like fighting, and it's just, control it, sling them out. Yeah. It's just part of the leisure business now.
I just need to jump in here, even though I'm one of the older people in this conversation. It's not just younger people.
Well, true.
Add alcohol to anybody. Yeah. And there is the potential for arseholery.
And class days as well.
I mean, anybody who's flown on to a package holiday destination, it's a typical flight, right?
It's all good fun, but at least in casinos, you've got a relatively captive audience. I mean, almost nobody has mandatory membership anymore. Grosvenor still do, but they're almost on their own now, where they know the name of everyone in the building. But as the safer gaming and anti-money laundering regulations stipulate, that an awful lot of people, you're going to track them anyway, so you know who they are, in case they develop a problem or in case they breach a AML threshold. You ID a lot of people from that anyway, and I think there's still a perception as you walk into a casino that if you misbehave, they'll be able to find out who you are. So that it makes things a bit more comfortable. But certainly, I would imagine in fairly short order, there'll be no membership left in casinos other than in Mayfair, which, my view is always that it just makes it, if you have membership, it makes it less likely that someone's going to cause a problem twice. You know, if people have had a couple of beers and emotions running high, then you know, from my time as a shift manager years and years ago, there's always idiots out there. At least there's no booze in arcades, which probably helps a little bit to keep things a bit more low key.
Yeah, somebody could always turn up drunk there.
Well,
but there's that kind of inverse thing as well. Like, the nicer the premises is, the less likely they are to mess around as well, right? So if it's there's that kind of the environment can have a huge impact on behavior.
And you've definitely got to hire management stroke staff, the customer ratio as well. You know, part of the job of a shift manager when they're not being weighed down with admin is just to be there on the floor and spot things that are headed towards problems before they happen. And again, from my time running shifts in Southampton, most of it was you're working with some very experienced shift managers, and they would kind of walk around the floor saying, that guy's going to be a problem in an hour. Just be aware of what's going on. And if you have to cut somebody off at the bar, then it's better to do it before they have the last one that's going to tip them over the edge, that kind of stuff. You've got a bit more firepower in casinos, I think. Now, I remember I worked in betting shops, was my first job in the business, and we literally did have a baseball bat clipped behind the door. It was never used, never even thought about, but it was there just in case.
How many TVs did you lose? How many TVs got smashed? That's the big one in the betting shops, right? The TVs.
All the FOBTs. Yeah, I'm so old that my time in betting shops was before we had FOBTs or machines of any sort. So it was just
the wireless.
I worked in one shop that didn't have a screen. They had the guy stood up marking the board with the prices, and it was an audio feed from SIS. But we are going back a bit. And it's kind of all the old betting guys, betting shop guys will tell you that, you know, when I was doing it 30 years ago, the, you know, the same guy would come in and do his 50p Yankee for £5.50 stake and would sit there for 2 hours watching his four horses. In the FOBT days, that same guy would be, you know, hammering them for £100 a day. It really did underline very directly the different level of risk from something like an FOBT compared to regular sports betting. And all right, this is back in the day when there'd be 15 minutes in between races on a weekday and nothing else to bet on apart from maybe a dog meeting. There wasn't any of the virtual racing or the Irish lottery and all that. It's a real illustration of how it's been ratcheted up to make it, you know, it, okay, gambling, it's a product with risks, but it's just gone kind of up the risk profile over the years very, very quickly. Doesn't mean to say it's a bad thing, I would argue. It's all about how you control things. But the difference between the betting shop experience 30 years ago and now is just night and day completely.
Mm. You can make that argument for pretty much everything in life, though.
Yeah.
I've always said this about... I appreciate... I probably shouldn't share this because the kids do listen sometimes. But weed and alcohol are similar. It was back when I was a puppy, you used to get some weed and you could sit and smoke all day and be totally, completely fine. And now everything you buy is super, super strength and gets you absolutely bollocks, I'm told.
Well,
but also alcohol.
Yeah.
You try and find a bottle of wine that is less than 14% alcohol. It's really, really difficult. You go find a pint of lager that is less than 5% alcohol. Used to be back in the day, your average pint of lager would be about 3.1%. Your average bitter would be about 2.93%. Even bitters now are up around 4.5%, 5%.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. No, absolutely. Yeah.
It's this weird drive towards efficiency. It even applies to getting bollocksed.
I always remember from my school days, Heineken was sneered at as a beer, and it was pretty much the cheapest thing in the shop, apart from Royal Dutch Lager. It was like 3.1%, didn't taste too good. And then I guess this is an illustration of what you're saying. They took it off the market, I think, relaunched it, I believe, when they started sponsoring the Rugby Premiership as a premium beer at whatever it is now, 4.8 or something. It's just, as you say, the perception seems to be just kind of turn everything up to 11 and.
But that coincided, I think, with they stopped brewing it in the UK. 3.1 was what was brewed in the UK, and I think it's imported now. And it's a completely different drink, but Fintan will be familiar with this story already. But that caused, not that specific, but it was very, very close to that. Because back in the day, in your average British pub, you would have your Heineken, and it wasn't great on tap.
No.
And that's your bog standard lager. And you might have like an Orangey Boom or a Stella, which was relatively uncommon 30 years ago.
Yeah.
And that would be your get super bollocksed kind of lager, right? And so in the pub that I worked in for a while, and it was a bit of a risque move that actually it turned out. But anyway, they switched out in the top bar, they switched out the Heineken between Christmas and New Year and replaced it with Stella. So it went from 3.1 to about 5.2. This is 30 years ago. And they had a 100-plus person riot on New Year's Eve because everybody went in and had their 10 pints.
Yeah, you're still thirsty. Yeah.
It was unbelievable. And they spilled out all down Corfe Street in Ludlow. And I know, but I wasn't in there at the time, but I know the guy that started it.
Sure. Yeah, it was somebody else.
I say started it. Somebody else hit him with, I can't remember if it was a glass or a bottle, but it escalated very quickly from there.
Yeah.
And I think we can say with some certainty that was strong alcohol.
Yes. Yeah. I wonder if it will come full circle to an extent. I was out in Liverpool last year with a mate of mine and in a proper old man pub, which tends to be where I head for these days. And they had a bitter there that was something like 2.9% advertised as a session ale. Tasted all right. So, you know, that was it. That was us for the day. Sit down there and, you know, punch out 12 or 14 pints of that, which is, you know, 9 pints or 8 pints in real money over the course of 6 hours. It was great. But that's not the experience most young people are looking for now, of sitting on a chair and talking bollocks all day.
I used to do that when I was up until probably my mid-20s when it started becoming harder to do. Me and a mate would meet up on a Saturday. We'd get the papers. We'd get the form from the bookies, the football coupon.
Yeah.
We'd go put on some outlandish bets and spend the day in an old man's pub drinking session bitter. You know, if we're lucky, we might find some. My favourite session bitter was always Ansell's.
I remember that.
That was a tasty beer.
There you go.
And not get fucked up.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
sounds like a great time
all day.
Sounds brilliant.
Like you sit around, you read the paper, you talk shit, you do. The amount of times I've come in, like 14 of my results have come in, but the 15th has disappointed me. I could have retired so many times on that last game. It's a fun day out and relatively inexpensive, and nobody throws up, nobody starts a fight.
And
the hell did we get onto this, Fintan?
what I find amazing is, perhaps with Fintan in mind, is how good the rest of Europe is at drinking. Well, I just think from the Dutch point of view, I'm probably a bit old for it now. I used to go to it's called Delirium. It's a poker tournament every year that's just for casino staff. Mm. It used to be every other year in Holland, somewhere in one of the Holland casinos. Now they send it all over the place. I went a couple of years ago, but it's all youngsters. But it went regularly up to about 5 years ago. And every time you go there, everyone was drinking all day. You know, you're talking 600 youngsters, mostly in their 20s and 30s. And they just, you know, champagne for breakfast. And you get to 10 o'clock at night and everyone's buzzed and having a great time, except there was usually a couple of English people, and there'd be Spaniard sat in a corner, you know, kind of semi-conscious. And it can't still be the hangover from when all the pubs used to close at 11, so you had to drink up by then. That's what people kind of tend to blame it on. But there's just something we don't seem to be able to do as a nation anymore. I don't really know why. I'm probably the same. All day drinking is a bit much for me now, but all the youngsters, you know, like I say, you'd never see them without a drink in their hand, but you'd never see them comb it either. It's bizarre.
What I've noticed is it's a glass of beer rather than a pint.
That'll help.
The way the Spanish approach it, they might go to 40 bars in the night, but they only have a little glass in it.
Yeah, right. So it's a biertje is the within the Netherlands. It's basically just a glass of beer, and then there's always food.
Right.
So even if it's just bitterballen or just like, you know, deep fried snacks or whatever, cheese sticks or whatever it is, there's always food. And they'll all serve food. Like you can easily get a meal or whatever. Like they'll all serve food as default. And it's bar food. And it's like, you know, it's fried eggs and bacon on toast kind of thing. Like it's not, it doesn't have to be fancy stuff. But that for me, I find now drinking, I can't drink pints. I get really full. It's just like, I just can't handle it anymore. It just feels like a lot.
That's probably
just more about me not drinking too much anyway. So, but yeah, the glass, basically just a glass of beer is the thing.
Yeah.
It'd be super unnormal to order a pint in the Netherlands.
Oh, really?
In the next episode of the Gambling Files podcast, you can hear all about old men and their prostates.
Yeah. Well, your listener profile is relatively old, so they must identify with some of this.
I'm not going to comment.
Young
on
at
that.
Heart. Young at heart.
There you go. You promised me a sponsor. They were all C level, so I'm assuming they can't all be in the
20s. All decision makers, Paul. We promise. They're all hiring. They're all hiring. They all need good recruitment.
Yeah, totally. I wasn't certainly wasn't denying the slide deck that we sent.
I must have missed that one.
We did slides.
The one with the detailed demographic breakdown by age, vertical, and
prostate swelling.
Well,
the infamous 13th slide.
I mean, who did the data gathering for that? But I had to wash their hands.
Couldn't possibly comment, Fintan, did you? Paul Scalfa, thank you very much for joining us on this very special, probably 99th episode of the Gambling Files podcast.
I figured you'd save the 100 for someone better.
Quite right, too.
Couldn't possibly comment.
They better be awesome now.
They are. Paul, thank you for joining us.
All righty. Thanks, guys.
If you've enjoyed this episode of the Gambling Files podcast, please find us on LinkedIn. Give us a big, juicy, succulent like. That nearly went wrong. You can find us under the name The Gambling Files Podcast. You can find us on Twitter under The Gambling Files. I think the handle is just at Gambling Files. You can connect to myself, John Bruford, or Fintan Costello, also on LinkedIn. We're also both on Twitter. And you can find all of our previous episodes at www.thegamblingfiles.com. If you enjoyed it, please share. Tell your friends, tell your family, tell your colleagues, and we'll see you next time.